Hey guys, this is the Brothers Wisps number 40, and there's only two of us. There could be only two. And as soon as I behead Thomas, there'll be only one, so we're good. We have with us today, down here, bottom left, big screen, he's like ginormous today, Thomas Kernek out of Slovakia.
Hello, hello everybody.
Excellent, and you have me, as always, Greg Sol. This is going to be a short and sweet one. Our list isn't very long, and Thomas looks like he's about ready to fall asleep anyway, so let's get this underway. One thing we have on here is we started a licensed backhaul comparison sheet, or at least I say we, Mike did. So far, he's only got 11 gigahertz gear, I want to say. Let me pop this open. I think he's got the Ubiquiti AFX 11 in there. What else did he have in there? Where's the Google Doc? Let me open that one up. There we go. He has the Mimosa B11 and the Alcoma 11 gigahertz in there. There's actually a decent bit of lively discussion on there. Some people saying that some of the numbers are maybe a bit misleading due to the channel widths required to get some of these readings. But it's really interesting, right? So it's hard to do apples to apples for any of this stuff. But he gets kind of as close as he possibly can talking about spectrum required for different amounts, and then even breaks it down to their throughput kind of dollars per bit, right? So even if one provider's gear may look a little bit more expensive than the other, if the dollars per bit work out, you know, you're going to be probably a happier camper. I'd like to see some more equipment on this list, right? Some other vendors with different frequencies. I don't know who else. Do you know anybody else that plays in the 11 gig spectrum? Maybe like the Siklu guys or
Not really, actually. We don't do much license stuff because for us it's pretty much just, you know, 2, 5, 24, and 60. So we don't actually do much of, and I personally don't do much of license. So.
Gotcha. Well, down here that's more of like a metro urban sort of problem, you know, where it just gets too noisy in those environments. Kind of going along with that is we have a license link show coming up pretty soon, and that's going to be with, I think, Liz Creekmore is her name. So she's one of those folks that helps you negotiate and acquire different spectrum licenses. And so if you have any questions, we're going to have a link here to the Brothers Wisp post about it. So just add any questions you have in there, and we'll be sure to throw them in on that one. Moving right along, Unimus adds Telnet. And I get to say, I told you so. Because I remember asking Thomas this a million years ago, and he said, no. Just no. Why would you do that?
Just Telnet. No, exactly.
How long did it take you to actually implement in?
About 4 days.
Okay. Was it worth it?
Every single of those days was extremely painful to me. It haunts me in my sleep to this day, but it's there. It's now, it works. It's functional, and if somebody really wants to do that kind of harm to themselves, now they can.
Well, I mean, what if they have a piece of legacy gear that only does?
Yes,
right?
I know something
like that. All right, so as everybody that listens to this show should know, Unimus is a backup system with a very gorgeous GUI, very simple. Does diffs, does all the good stuff you want, and installs in, what, less than half hour?
Yeah, you could go from nothing to backing up 1,000 devices in 15 minutes.
Rock and roll. Anything new coming down the pipe soon?
Oh, yeah. We are actually releasing 030, which will be RC1 next week, probably Monday, if everything goes well. If not, Tuesday.
Okay.
And it's a huge changelog. We have added support for 15 vendors / devices, and just a lot of stuff.
Rock and roll.
And I'm extremely excited because it's the biggest release yet, and it's full of good stuff.
That's cool. So are you actually taking money for this yet?
Most actually of our people are still on testing beta licenses. But since 030 is RC1, we will actually be slowly moving all those people from the beta licenses to actual production licenses. And, you know, when we actually launch, then all of those beta licenses will be converted to normal licenses. So
Rock and roll.
As in, people will actually have to purchase instead of having all the, you know, thousands of devices for free for testing purposes.
Right. I have zero guilt associated with that because your licensing prices are actually really affordable. So, it's
No, you know, it's, I really think like every single little device should actually be backed up, because even financially it makes sense. You know, a single lightning strike can introduce tens of hours of you know, fixing and reconfiguration and everything, and you know, for a few bucks you can actually not have to deal with all that. So.
Yeah, especially if you're what, sort of like an MSP where everything is customized and one-off, right? You start with a template, but everybody's a little bit different, so you save yourself a lot of heartache, a lot of time.
I mean, I don't want to talk about other solutions that are out there, but when I actually go on their websites and I see things like, you know, starting at $3,000, I you know, it's kind of ridiculous that still there was no solution that would actually be easy, fast, and cheap to work with. So.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for the cloud version so I can just be ultimate lazy and just push a couple buttons. Click, click, I'm done. All right. Anything else on the Unimus front that you want to talk about?
Well, I mean, just the release is coming out next week, so hopefully if we can get people to the new version as soon as possible, if somebody wants to help us and beta test it and all of that, you know, we will be very happy. But that's it, really.
Very cool. All right, moving right along in some more or less interesting news. A buddy of mine named Jimmy, he has a drone of some sort. I'm sure he outlines it in his blog post. But he strapped an access point to it. So he removed the camera, he put an access point, and he does site surveys with it now. So he'll move it up to some elevation, and he'll put it in, I think, what did he call it, rabbit mode, something like that, where it will just hover in place, and then he can trim it left and right to dial in, so he can actually figure out how big a mast exactly he needs for this person's house to get like maximum signal, or just make sure that he can get clear line of sight or whatever. So it's actually kind of an interesting idea. I know people have been using drones for tower surveys recently and things like that, right? You can go up, take a look at your gear, document it, right, with the camera, all those images and stuff. But here's somebody actually putting it to use to... I mean, I've seen people do site surveys. They just have a big pole in their truck that they pull out, right? But this could, if, say, it's a new tower site or something like that, I mean, you could use it for that, right? If you need to go 50 feet, 100 feet, you could actually get a decent reading. And so he's using, I think he's using like an SXT Lite or an SXT AC Lite, whichever one has the 5 gig radio and the 2.4 for management. So he just has his phone up and then lets the 2.4 connect to that and then goes up and does the site survey via 5. So it's pretty neat.
No, that has to actually be some kind of a heavier duty drone to be able to carry that too.
Yeah, it's a bit beefy, but it's not something everybody's got in their backyard. But he's got no kids, so he's got a little bit more disposable income for toys. And I'm saying that to the guy that's got like the full VR setup at his house.
Oh, come on.
Yeah. Let's see.
I'm sure a drone that could actually carry an SXT is you know, much more extravagant than that.
I don't know. I think his drone was like $250, $300, something like that. So it's not...
Oh, really? Wow.
Not terrible, I don't think. Although, I'm saying that, I mean, I'm shooting from the hip here. It might have been $600. I don't know, to be honest with you.
We actually, here, we have a really hilly terrain, so there's tons of obstacles. And we've actually been using a drone for just a camera, you know, visual line of sight confirmation for quite some time now. But it's a Parrot too, which is a quite older drone, right? But that one has no chance to carry something as such as SXT. So either the drone technology has progressed so far in the last like 2.5 years that I've actually been interested in it, that you know that's what $200 drones can do now, or you know, It's amazing how much that technology is evolving.
That's crazy. Especially when it's entertainment, how fast that stuff progresses.
Actually, there was one of my friends/guys that I do some consulting for. Hi, Shane. was showing me just a few weeks ago that you can actually now do LiDAR systems on drones that can do 3D mapping of sites and of all of that. So you actually get full 3D map that's, you know, much more than just pictures, because you can actually replay it and, you know, play with it inside of 3D actual software post fact, you know, after you take the actual survey. And it's amazing how much the technology has gone forward.
That's crazy. And LiDAR is like laser radar, right?
Yeah, so you can actually do, you know, extremely precise mapping with LiDAR of sites. You just program it to fly in a certain trajectory and scan everything around, and then you just retrieve the data, and you can, you know, you actually have a fully mapped, like, volumetric environment map that you can play with and go around and do stuff.
That's cool. I wonder how long before you know, Google Earth starts flying around drones and mapping all our cities out like that.
I guess there are still issues with the aviation and other authorities. That's mostly the issue.
Fair enough. So moving right along, Mike posted up something about the Radwin gear. He was just asking if anybody's ever used Radwin for their point to multipoint. He articulated a little bit better gear. I have not. I don't think I know anybody that has. Let's see. I think the same unit, it must be, what is it? What do you call that? Software defined? Because it says in the same unit you can do from 3.3 gig all the way up to 5.8 gigahertz. So it can go from licensed frequencies all the way up to non-licensed in the same gear. Although maybe they're just saying kind of like the same chassis form factor. But the way it sort of reads makes it sound like it can. I think it also does beamforming. What else are they talking about on this thing? 3 gigs per cell. That way that's with 4 sectors using 2 80 megahertz channels. It sounds like a lot of spectrum, I guess, depending on what frequency you're in. I don't know really much about it, but I guess if anybody's listening and they have used it, let us know. Seems interesting. No idea on pricing or anything like that either. Any of that interest you in the least?
I mean, to me, it's not that interested simply because of the conditions that we have here with licensed spectrum and unlicensed spectrum. For us to get even like 10 or 20 megahertz of licensed spectrum is it's just not worth it. It's just not doable for a small company. And yeah, well, it's Slovakia, so things are just sometimes, you know, unmovable and strange. So as I mentioned, I deal really very little with licensed stuff.
How have those power outages been treating you?
Oh God, don't get me started.
Pour some salt in that wound.
So I guess for everybody else, just to explain, there we have actually had 5 major power outages in the last 2 months, all of them lasting pretty much between 3 and 6 hours, and it's just been a serious pain.
What time of day are those usually happening?
Oh, just completely random, you know. Sometimes at 4 at night, sometimes at 12 in the afternoon. It's to be fair, we had some very heavy snowfall here. And then, you know, that all started melting. And we are expecting the yearly wave of, floods and all of that to come soon. it's really strange to me how the power technology, you know, electricity has been around for more than 100 years now. And it's a simple analog system, or one would think it is, right? And they still cannot have it properly function. It's, yeah.
Well, it kind of makes sense, because you have to transport it outside, right? So you have to deal with nature or whatever. And I guess, I mean, in the cheapest way possible.
I guess there's that, and, you know, old power lines and all of that. But how hard can it be to make a power grid redundant? I mean, I'm not anywhere near a power engineer or anything. I'm just thinking, you know, we can make super crazy complicated IP networks that are, you know, redundant on every single, and like quadruple redundant on every single layer if we wanted to. Of course, there's the money issue, but
yeah.
How hard can it be to? And I don't know. Maybe I'm bashing something that, you know, than a proper engineer will come in and say, oh yeah, just try to do that, good luck with that.
What?
But I mean, it would seem,
we tell a lot of customers the same sort of thing. We can make it as redundant as you want, as long as you're willing to pay for it, you know.
Yeah,
people don't want to pony up the dough, then it's just not going to happen.
No, it's just been driving me crazy because, you know, five major outages in such a short time, and this is not, you know, 10 minutes. So our UPSs are way over capacity, like over actually what we need, right? We actually can run for 2.5 hours on the UPSs before we have to start the generators, which I think is you know, it's more than usually people
Yeah,
have, right?
yeah. Usually you're looking
And
at, if it's like a small site, usually you think about 15, 20, 30 minutes, something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah, we can easily do 2 to 2.5 hours on UPSs alone because we know that our power grid is just crap. But what's been happening recently is just it's just been driving me crazy.
Sounds like it's time for you guys to get like an automatic switch gear with a generator that's going to fire on its
Yeah.
own sort of thing.
So we are currently actually thinking about two options: either getting a proper diesel generator with auto start and all of that, because we currently have generators, of course, but we have to manually start them. It's little gasoline ones. Well, little, I mean, you know, it's 6 kilowatt, but you know. Or we have been thinking about actually going with a lot of solar, so cover the entire office in solar, get a lot of batteries, and store a lot of energy in solar, and you know, hope that just stack up on batteries all the way.
So what's the climate like? I'm assuming it's pretty cold. You said it snows a lot. Would you guys actually do diesel or would you do like natural gas? Is that an option for you guys?
No, I probably would do diesel rather than natural gas. Yeah, we haven't like done deep research into it yet. We are
Yeah.
still trying to decide what's economically better, what's economically better, what's more, you know, scalable. Can we even get enough power from solar for all that we need? But we definitely have to do something about it sooner rather than later.
Fair enough. I suppose solar's the cleaner option, but diesel's usually the cheaper option, I think. Although you have to do maintenance on the diesel, but you have to do maintenance
Yeah,
on your
exactly.
battery plant, so.
Oh yeah. But we also have some fairly good government subsidies for solar, so
Oh,
we
that
are also
helps.
exploring those options. But you know, that's for our like our main office where all our racks are, our servers, all our equipment. But even for our wireless side and our wireless retransmission sites, those actually have 6 hours of battery capacity because you know it's just a couple of radios, and you know the total consumption is maybe like 30 to 40 to 50 watts, right? And you can do that easily with just normal batteries. You don't we just run 24 volts. We don't run actual UPSs there, you know, because of power conversion that we don't need to do. But the problem with those is, you know, it can take a single outage, but then to recharge, it takes, you know, potentially like, you know, 30 hours to recharge the battery. So, and those doing solar on most of those is actually not an option for us. So we don't know what we will do about all the actual wireless points. We are just, you know, it's become a really big problem, and we don't know what to do yet.
Well, good luck to you.
Oh, well, thank you.
If anybody listening has any options for you that are probably solid and affordable, man, send them along. Let's see, moving right along. I saw this on the Nanog list because whenever I'm pulling all of the Facebook bullet points for these things, I also usually try and pop in on the Nanog list, see if there's anything interesting. And I saw that somebody had posted up a link saying that dense wave division multiplex DWDM gear is now cheaper than coarse wave gear at FiberStore, and it's FS.com. I've actually bought some stuff from FS, and I know a lot of other folks that have, and they've actually gotten a pretty decent reputation. Not just because they are like the absolute cheapest place you can buy that ships straight from China, but it looks like they OEM a lot of the major manufacturers. So when we're talking about dense wave versus coarse wave, this is an idiot's interpretation. It's where you're using different frequencies of light on a single fiber, right? So just think about one strand, you run different frequencies, or even two strands, right? And you're just running different frequencies. So you can actually have multiple connections on that same piece of fiber. You just run them at different frequencies of light so they don't interfere with each other, right? So coarse wave, think coarse as in not as many channels, right? So the optics will float a little bit in those frequency ranges, so they're not as tight. Whereas dense wave, they're more densely packed, and so the optics are generally or at least traditionally, they were more expensive because they had to stay within like kind of tighter tolerances. From what I understand, I think Andrew Thrift told me that whenever they were creating optics, they would test them, and if they stayed really well within tolerances, they'd make them dense. If they were not as clean as they should be, they'd just mark them as coarse wave and sell them anyway. So I think it's interesting. I know traditionally from my research, coarse wave, those optics don't usually have to stay within as tight of temperature requirements, right? So you can put them in kind of a rougher environment, whereas the dense wave, I think, were more sensitive to temperature, right? I guess it would make the frequencies change a bit. But anyway, long story short, if you look at FiberStore, if you're looking at an 80 kilometer, 10 gig coarse wave optic, they're about $600. A dense wave is about $420 now. So the price is actually flip-flop. Coarse used to be cheaper, and then I think about a year ago, coarse and dense got really close, like neck and neck, and now the dense stuff. And I guess that's probably economies of scale, don't you think? More people are just purchasing and using dense, and so they're creating more of them, and thus the price is getting cheaper. What do you reckon?
I think it's also due to the massive amount of research and development and everything that's been going on with lasers lately. Constantly there is something improving, and constantly there is new technologies, new materials, and you know, I think it's a combination of all of those factors that has made this.
That's cool, and I know a lot of people think, you know, that division, you know, wave division is something you have to go into a really expensive mux with all this powered gear, and it's just crazy. But you can actually, I mean, the coarse wave and dense wave stuff, just think of one fiber goes into, I believe, like a prism. It splits it out into a whole bunch of different fibers. Those different fibers will have labels for the different frequencies, and you just get a colored optic. So you basically buy an SFP, an SFP plus, a QSFP, I mean, whatever the interface type is, in the right color, and you just make sure your fiber jumpers go into that slot. And the muxing part actually is passive, right? There's no power required on that thing. So it's a lot of times a really inexpensive way to reuse an existing strand of fiber to get so much more. I mean, I haven't priced it on the 40 gig and the 100 gig side, but the 10 gig stuff, you know, $420. I think the 1 gig versions are closer to $100 or sub $100 a piece. So it's really affordable. It's a whole lot cheaper than putting in new fiber. I know that much, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So as long as you have dark end in, and I think the muxes going in there for like 16 channels, I think they're $1,500 or less per side. So really inexpensive stuff. So it's interesting if you guys have done any fiber or thinking about doing fiber, or you go into a project where you're out of strands, but you need some new connectivity. Yeah, this gives you an option. Anything to say about that? We good?
Always better than pulling new fiber. Anything is better than pulling new fiber. Right?
Anything's better. You know, if it's something you already have and you can just reuse it and save a ton of money, why not, man? And I'm a big proponent of gear that's not powered. I love the idea of putting a mux in there that's not actually powered, and so you don't have to introduce another piece of gear that's pulling off your plant that you have to make sure stays up. Let's see, speaking about FiberStore, Thomas brought it back up, and I think Mike had sent out a link at some point or another, but they're actually carrying some active switches over there now. I don't think there's any brand name associated with these, so...
Oh, it's just FiberStore.
Yeah, it's just... FiberStore. I'm gonna go out on a limb and assume that they didn't go to a manufacturer and say, "Hey, create me these brand new switches." I'm thinking they just found something that was pseudo OEM, white label, and then just grabbed a whole bunch of them. But they have some crazy good prices on this gear. And if any of you guys have used any of it or know anybody that has, and maybe like the Nanog list would probably be a good place to post it up and say, "Hey, have any of you guys used this stuff?" But they have like a 48 gig SFP switch, right? So that's going to be 48 port gig fiber switch with four 10 gig SFP pluses out, and those are $2,000 a piece. And that's just crazy dirt cheap. I'm not even sure if they have too many specs Later on in here, they're saying layer 2.3.
So when I was looking at it, the full specs were not out yet, which they might be at this point. But it does most of the stuff that you know normal people would want out of those switches. From what I remember, it didn't pass all the points from my switch requirements list yet. But as I mentioned, the specs weren't complete at the time where I was looking into it. So, but the pricing is extremely good.
Yeah, it looks like they have hot swap power supplies, hot swap fans, normal amount of VLANs, and if you're just doing switching, it says non-blocking throughput, 88 gigs. So that's...
I mean, it will always be a question of software quality, right? Will the software that's in there be stable, be good, be nice to work with, etc., etc.? I mean, I don't think anybody is going to put these into really serious networks without some actual, you know, proper testing and all of that. It's a completely new, well, I guess you could say vendor to active equipment anyway. And, you know, who knows, it's Chinese OEM equipment, so who knows what kind of software it's running in there, you know, what's hiding in there and all of that. So I think it will be interesting, and Fiberstar actually is really interested in becoming an active equipment vendor, basically, and then manufacturer, right, if this is something that they want to deal with long-term or not. And I guess time will show.
And, I mean, my thinking, too, is for... That looks like an aggregation switch, right? 48 SFP slots with some 10 gig out. There's not a whole lot of features you generally need in an aggregation switch. Because usually aggregation, you don't need like DHCP snooping or ARP inspection. You really just need something to prevent loops and LACP, right? For trunking, a little bit of redundancy. So,
you know, it depends what the requirements are, right? For me, still, without LLDP, without radius support, without proper SNMP implementation that exposes all of those MIPS that I need, you know, it's still a useless switch.
Yeah. So, $2,000, they only need, what, about 10 features, and you're sold?
Yeah, definitely.
All right. One of those features is be reliable, I guess?
Oh, yeah. Don't, you know... if I put it somewhere, I want it to work. So
yeah. All right. So let's now talking about the beyond 10 gig capacity. They do have, it looks like, four other products in there, and those are going to be 10 gig aggregation switches with 40 gig uplinks, and those go from 32 to 48 ports, and those range from $4,000 to $8,800. And those are going to have QSFP pluses, which are going to be 40 gig interfaces out. And then they actually have a 40 gig aggregation switch, which has 20 40 gig QSFP pluses with 4 100 gig output interfaces. And that one's $7,000. And those prices are pretty crazy.
Yeah, that's...
I don't think I've seen that anywhere else.
Yeah, for that kind of connectivity, no chance.
Yeah. But again, I don't know anything about these other than the pricing is really interesting, and Fiberstar has a fairly decent reputation on what they've sold so far. This is my, or rather, I don't know, maybe their first foray into the switching. I don't remember ever seeing any on there, so.
No, I don't think they ever did anything like that they actually, from active equipment that they manufactured and sold, so.
That's cool. I wish I could actually... be able to push that stuff in a test environment. I don't have anything.
Somebody from Fiberstar is listening, you know, send us some. We'll be glad to test them for you.
Thomas, do you have the capacity to test a 40, like a 20 QSFP plus switch?
I will test if it's stable. I will test if it has all the software features, you know, all the wonderful stuff.
And you can integrate them all into Unimus too, right?
Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it'll help them to help you. That'll be great. Awesome. All right.
You know, it will finally give me that excuse to buy 40 gigabit network cards for our cluster.
There you go. Or maybe they can send you some. You can test those too.
Oh, yeah. You know, if you send me the networking cards, then I will be able to test the forward link plane properly as well. You know.
Awesome. So we always like to have some bad news in all of our casts, of course. Even without Mike here. There's apparently a Cisco clock signal component failure recall on a bunch of different switches. So if you have something, and apparently it still has to be under warranty, or I think you have to have support on it, otherwise they're not going to mail you a new one. But they are apparently drop shipping people new gear. So if you have anything in there, Cisco, that you think might be on that list, it looks like after about 18 months, this component failure makes the switch just stop working. So...
Oh, and it's not just switches. It's actually a bunch of different Cisco stuff. A lot of ASAs, you know, ASAs, and also there is some Nexus plane controllers and all that kind of stuff, even for high-end gear. And Cisco is saying that it will just fail after 18 months of operation and won't boot anymore.
Oof, yeah. So optical networking, routing, security, switches—they've got a little bit of everything on the list.
Yeah, quite awesome.
Meraki stuff too, right?
Oh yeah, Meraki, definitely.
Everything. Yeah. Everything is on there. Yikes. All right.
And actually, Cisco is saying that, of course, it's a component from a different manufacturer. You know, it's obviously not a Cisco hardware thing. But Cisco is saying other vendors and other networking equipment are using the same clocking signal switches, signal processors or generators. And so it's interesting how this will affect any other vendors, because as far as I've watched this entire situation evolve, no other vendor has actually published any recalls or any notifications about this fault. So, but Cisco is specifically and multiple times saying that other vendors are affected by this as well, because OEM chips, so it will be interesting how much of an impact this will have on the entirety of networking industry, or even on the high end, what you could call high end of the networking industry. And also the fact that they are only exchanging stuff that has warranty at the time of the finding is a little bit shady, but
it's better than nothing, I guess.
I guess.
Oh, well. I will never question the motivations of a big corporation. It's always money number one, right?
On the other side of the bad news front, there was actually also a fault discovered in the Ubiquiti Edge switches, where they can actually output 24 volts on all of the ports after, in certain situations after a reboot.
Right. And I think somebody said they had a laptop plugged in and it cooked it, right?
Oh, yeah, it can cook all kinds of things. And this is actually particularly particular concern for me, because we deployed a bunch of Ubiquiti Edge switches. Some of our listeners may remember that me saying that I really don't like Ubiquiti products, except for the switches, which up until now I actually considered a good product. And so it turns out it can actually cook your laptops. It can completely, short or kill devices plugged into it, because it will output 24 volts on all Ethernet ports under certain conditions on a reboot. Which is just, thank you, Ubiquiti.
Yeah, I think, was it Tom Smith who said he was using PoE injectors and just not plugging in PoE so that it would... I guess diodes to keep it from surging back through. So it seems like a rig, but I mean, if it works, it works, I guess.
And it's actually interesting as well, because there have been reports from various people, various websites, various reviewers in the last year that QA process, quality control, And quality assurance processes as Ubiquiti were quite bad, and multiple people have received dead on arrival equipment and from factory damaged equipment and all of that. And now this kind of a thing happens. So, I don't have any. This is not personal experience, because we don't use Ubiquiti. Ubiquiti wireless for me is just a useless thing, because of many reasons that I don't want to get into. But those switches, those were actually really good, and then things like this happens, and it makes you wonder how such a thing gets past quality assurance.
I have no idea. I can't even begin to speculate on that stuff. I'm so outside of my wheelhouse to know how any of that stuff works. since you talked about Ubiquity, it made me think of TP-Link. You know, because you were talking about how much you like the Ed switches. It popped in my head. I was talking to Disher the other day, and he was like, "Man, have you seen these new TP-Link access points?" Looking at the, what are they, like the N600, the AC1200. Have you seen those guys? So they look like a Unify AP, pretty much, only sort of square. And so looking at them a little bit, if you look at their web interface, because they're controller-based, they look like the controller looks just like Unify. And I don't mean like, hey, that's sort of similar. Like, it looks like a screen scrape of Unify. And from what I can tell, these guys operate and adopt just like Unify. So if I was a betting man, I would say TP-Link put the crosshairs on Ubiquity with this product for sure, trying to kill them on it. I only know one guy who's used them a little bit, and he's saying that they're working pretty well. I think I would, you know, wait a little while to just wait and, you know, just hear a few more people, although it might be interesting to give them a go and mess with them. But supposedly, antenna-wise, signal-wise, I'm willing to bet if you broke them down, they are built like a Unify. And TP-Link, I mean, traditionally, their switch line, their Jetstream stuff's been pretty solid, pretty good. You know, and then some of their other small access points been pretty good. So I'd be curious to see if this product matures a bit and really kind of takes a little bit of market share away from Unify. That would be an interesting one.
It might actually also be interesting due to the fact that there has been some, and I don't want to, you know, I don't want to speculate on how much, because I don't know firsthand, but there has been some personnel movement at the Ubiquity. We've seen multiple people, I would guess key personnel, leave from Ubiquity, from the EdgeRouter team. And so I wonder if there might have been, you know, if TP-Link actually acquired some talent from Ubiquity specifically to be able to engineer it and make it software engineer it so similar, or if it, this is just a pure, you know, let's do it that way because that way is nice and good and people like it.
Yeah. You're comfortable with this, you like the way it works. Well, guess what? Ours is too. Only our access points are a few points cheaper, you know. Jump in, see what you can do. I think that's pretty cool. But speaking of ISP supplies, Disher asked me the other day if I knew of anybody looking for a job. He's looking for a tech, somebody familiar with WISP industry equipment, you know, MikroTik, Ubiquity, maybe the Siklu, maybe the Bicells, any of that stuff, just kind of how some of that stuff works. I guess he's looking for a tech to sort of be sales support, stuff like that. If you are interested, reach out to them. I know Ricky was helping him trying to acquire talent, so I'd say reach out, get a hold of Steve or Hunter or Ricky or any of those guys and let them know you're interested if you are. So there you go, Steve. I put it out there. Let's see. Do you have anything, any closing thoughts today, Thomas? Anything else you'd like to throw in?
Not really. Not off the top of my head.
All right, me neither. So for all of you guys that are listening, be sure to jump on Facebook, like us on there as well. If you do, you'll see constant feed material, I think at least once a day, usually twice a day, Mike's putting something up. And that is Mike Hammack that's always putting that stuff up, so he keeps it moving, keeps it lively. There's a lot of good conversations, a lot of good discourse. If you have any questions or comments for us, that's probably the fastest way to get them to us over there. Otherwise, if you're old school, you can hit us on contactus@thebrotherswisp.com. And I guess if nothing else, Thomas, where can people find you in the real, not the real world, because you don't want them finding you in the real world. If you'd like people to find you on the internet, how can they do that?
All the usual channels. Just Google my name. I'm everywhere. Facebook, LinkedIn, you know, all the contact channels. I'm pretty easy to find.
Yeah, pop over to unimus.net. Find them over there.
Oh, yes, please help us find all the bugs and fix all the bugs and make it better for everybody.
You got to always pimp it, man. You got to push that brand. You can find me at gregsoul.com, very original, where I used to blog, and now it's more just kind of an archive of my better days. Occasionally, I'll put new stuff out. But that's probably the best way to get a hold of me. You can also email me. Don't try and friend me on Facebook because I'm a recluse and I never friend anybody on there. I've recently joined the Wisp Talk group on Facebook, and I pop on there maybe once a week, but there's a lot of really good conversation in there. I like that one a lot. So look for us there as well. If nothing else, thanks, guys. Appreciate you listening, and hope you come back next time.
See everybody.